Good morning, everybody. It's the Danny Baker Show, radiating out across the airwaves. Come the sunshine or the rain, come aboard the Danny train. We'll kick our slippers off and throw our cares away. What better thing to do than have a jolly jape or two? Don't touch that dial, there's nowhere else to go. Come and join a happy session, wave ta-ta to the recession on the Danny Baker Show.
Take it away, Danny.
Thank you very much indeed.
On digital and online, bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call 0500 909 693. Calls are free from most landlines, but some networks and mobile operators will charge. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Doing an early run through of Ziggy Stardust for his own benefit. And here's the thing with David Bowie. Whenever I run into him on a, you know, I fancy I know quite a bit about Bowie. And I always say the best book written about Bowie is called Any Day Now, The London Years, 47 to 74 by Kevin Cairn. But I'd never met Kevin until the other week. And we're doing this thing called The People's History of Pop for BBC Four. One BBC, we can say that. And Kevin is the curator and collector and just the greatest authority on Bowie I've ever met. And I thought I was until I met Kevin. And he joins us this morning to talk about David Bowie, his relationship with him. Because you knew Bowie, didn't you?
I did. I was very fortunate, Danny. Yeah. Spent some quality time with him.
Well, let's talk about you just for the first bit here. By the way, I looked up some of the things he was doing today. I think tonight he was playing at the 2 tons or somewhere in...
3 tons.
The 3 tons, yeah. That would be
Don't leave the
actually,
ton out.
I've got it now. No, it wasn't, actually. See, I've got correcting you straight away. This day in 1968, Bowie was playing at the Nag's Head, York Road, Battersea.
Oh.
Some seats still available if you want to get along to the Nag's Head tonight in 1968. So what was your first... Because your the stuff you have, the knowledge you have, the information you have, is not very celebrated when you hear a lot of people who talk about Bowie, and you've very quietly become the keeper of the Bowie flame in all kinds of ways. How did you get involved with David Bowie in the first place?
Just like everybody else early on, just knocked six by this incredible character who suddenly dominated the airwaves in 72. But I hadn't realised that, I'd been singing along to David for years, really. In 69, when I was a kid and my friends, we were singing Space Oddity. In 71, my friend's brother had Hunky Dory, and, I thought, great cover. Can I have a copy of it? And we were listening to it, can I have a copy of it? So everything was cassette. I couldn't afford albums then, I was just about occasionally being able to buy a single, Things were tight. So, got this cassette of Hunky Dory. All he put on there was Hunky Dory, so he didn't write David Bowie. So I'm playing this cassette to death. I mean, it meant everything to me, along with lots of others, but that one in particular. And so when Ziggy came along and Starman, and didn't at first even connect it then, it took a few more weeks, and then suddenly I thought, that voice sounds so, I can't believe it. It's the same man. And that was an incredible moment.
But see, here's the thing, Kevin. So, you and I are both the same in that, and I suspect millions of other people are.
Yes.
And yet, your life, to a certain degree, has since become overwhelmed by it.
It has
become your life.
It was for a while, Danny. There's a huge amount of things that I do. But very luckily, early on, I realised that David was somebody that really needed to be studied. And before I realised it, I was keeping not just the cuttings, but dates as well, and just every kind of little bit of extra information.
Well, I couldn't believe when I first saw Any Day Now, your book, I couldn't believe it, because I've read every Bowie book, and I'll read every Bowie book that comes out, but they're all of a type. Yes. You know, the story's there.
It's set.
And, you know, it might be odd nuggets here and there. I've never seen anything like it. It seemed that everything he'd ever done, and in the best way, day by day. The only reason I know that today in 1971, Peter Noon's version of Oh You Pretty Things was released on this day in 1971. But your book, Day by Day, says what he's doing.
Yes.
Not in a dry sense. Yeah. It is absolutely absorbing. There are photographs, school reports, everything. I didn't know such a person existed like you. When did that start happening?
I think it even dates back to my interest in art, and I wanted to be an artist when I was at school.
Yeah.
And I said to you the other day, you know, the great thing about David at that time is he had an arts lab. And I thought, well, when I leave school, forget everything else, I'm going to join this arts lab. And, you know, that's it. I don't need to worry about anything else. And, of course, you know, the arts lab...
What is an arts lab?
Yeah, I think it was just an evening folk club kind of thing. You know, God knows what I'd have done, Danny. You know what, I would have been useful.
I've never asked that question before. I've heard, oh, Bowie's arts lab. Oh, Bowie had an arts lab. I had no idea until I just said it out loud what it could possibly be.
It was actually, you know, not just... they were encouraging all kinds of performance. Yeah. So people could stand up and do poetry. They could put on a light show. They could be mime. David would mime.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So it was something that he'd seen at the Arts Lane in Drury Lane.
Yeah.
And that was in the back of his mind. And so, and being, you know, and that's where Kemp and Berkoff and all kinds of people were performing.
But your connection was just that you thought, yeah, I'm like him, Arts Lab, I'll do that.
I'm an artist. Yeah. That's what I thought at the time. You know, it took a bit longer to realise I couldn't paint as good as everybody else. But that I came from that. But to cut the story even shorter, I was reading about a lot of artists, and one of my favourites is Aubrey Beardsley, a draftsman. And there's a beautiful book out, The Letters of Aubrey Beardsley, which is still my favourite book. And that was all dates and events, because it was all the letters.
Oh, that's done, of course, yeah.
And I just thought, wow, how important is this book? Without this, we wouldn't know what was going on in this guy's life.
Well, that's the key to it. And I was selling, because as I say, there's other Bowie books are available and that, but I do believe it's a format, rather like Ian MacDonald did with Revolution in the Mind with the Beatles, which broke down the songs. This is the stuff that helps fans and people interested in it. This is how they lived. This is what they did. This is how this happened.
Yes.
And it's not just anecdotal or dry, and it's a terrific thing. So what was the first amount of... let's call it memorabilia, but this is curation. What is the first stuff that you took possession of David Bowie's?
I suppose it was because quite early on I was starting to interview people.
Yeah.
I realised that, you know, all these people were available. As long as you could prove that, you know, you were bona fide and, you know, you were doing a job, they were quite happy to talk to you. Some were more guarded. The ones that were closer to David were a lot more guarded. And so I didn't bother them. I spoke to people that were in the early bands.
Yeah.
And early management and, you know, involved in the lighting. Mm-hmm. And everybody had something or other, a little bit of memorabilia or, you know, even if it was just an anecdote. But, for example, I would go along to, you know, Natasha Kornilov, who, now Natasha, very underrated lady, she was the person that first put David in costume with Lindsay Kemp. And, you know, how important that became to David in the long run.
But it's the actual physical things that...
When I was with Natasha, I said, oh, you don't have any old costume designs. And she had a couple of old costume designs, one of Lindsay stroke David costume with beautiful Pyrrho, beautifully painted and watercoloured. And she just gave it to me.
That's why you're Kevin Kane, because I'd have sat there and said, yeah, I am, and you're not having it. That's why you're gaining the trust of these people over
here.
Yes. You don't do like I do and walk around town saying, look at this, it's David Bowie's. And I mean it in the best way.
Yes.
And so you started collecting the art stuff.
Yes.
And then wasn't Ken Pitt his first manager, the real...
Yeah. Ken was fantastic.
The lodestone.
We, you know, I went over to interview Ken one day at 39 Manchester Street, and any Bowie fan knows anything about David. 39 Manchester Street's right up there, because David moved there, left home to, you know, make his break in 67, and moved into Ken's place. And so to interview Ken at that building, for a start, where a lot of the demos, a lot of things happened, was very important. And he left there short a few years afterwards. But we got on really well. The article came out. He liked it. And I just stayed in touch. And whenever I was in town, I gave him a call. And if he was in, I'd pop in. And, we just became good mates, and it was always
but Bowie's stuff was still there, wasn't it?
Masses. He had loads of stuff, and he did sell bits and pieces over time, and I'd come in and suddenly something was missing, and I'd go, oh, you know, I didn't know you were going to sell that. Well, I didn't know I was going to sell it.
What kind of things are we talking
about? He had the award for Best Hope 1970, you know, that David was awarded by Disco Music Echo. That was on the side. Lovely sort of record disc kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that was always on the side, and one day it wasn't there, and he said, oh, no, this girl came in the other day, and she offered me something for it, and I said, well, why not, you know? And I thought, oh, why didn't I offer you something for it?
But that said, he entrusted you and
I'm looking after Ken's archive.
Yeah.
And which is kept, so everybody knows, in a nice, secure location, at my home.
That's the thing, isn't
you
it?
You know, believe me,
you've got to realise a lot of people are absolutely...
Absolutely.
I thought I knew pretty much about Ed Bowie until I visited... your place.
And what I did when you came round is I brought a lot of things out of storage as well. So
exactly.
Because I wanted you to see things.
I hope you don't mind me saying, but I've been telling these stories ever since I saw your stuff.
Don't mind.
Because not only unreleased David Bowie stuff, but absolutely stuff that had never been on the radar. People don't know exists.
What sort of took you back the most?
Can I say what took me back the most?
Go on.
David Bowie famously at one point... what's that playing in my head? Can I hear music or is it just not playing? David Bowie, famous at one point, wanted to write the words to My Way. There was a competition to put...
It wasn't necessarily a competition. It was a music publisher. Yeah. They'd got the French version out. They liked it. It could be a hit. We need English lyrics too.
We need English lyrics. And Bowie thought, well, I can do that.
He worked for Essex.
I've heard about that. And, of course, eventually Paul Anka wrote the famous And Now the End is Near and So I Face the Final Curtain. But Bowie... That fact in itself, that Bowie had a go at that, I didn't know he'd actually recorded his version.
Yeah. Not just once, actually, a few times.
And you've got it. That's the thing. The actual
I've got all the versions.
Physical record. And tell us, it's actually not him with a band singing, is it?
It's straight over the record that Claude Francois made. He was one of the singer on the original, you know. And so, David, on the actual demo tapes, you hear him trying to put the needle on for about 15, 20 times, can't get it in the same place, and he's getting cross, you know. Eventually hits it, and then rolls out his version of A Fool Learns to Love.
What's the opening line of it? Do you know what he sings as the opening line?
There was a time, a happy time, I used to go to every party.
And I'd heard about this, and I thought maybe they'd written down, but Kevin is. His archive is so full of records that, as I say, I didn't know were existed or undocumented. And hearing that, probably only beaten by you were good enough to play some of these sessions for something like The Laughing Gnome and in the speeded up voices, they're swearing some pretty good stuff.
thing about a lot of those, I mean, what is so fantastic about listening to, you know, luckily I've been able to hear some of the outtakes from this first album and the things. And, you know, you did hear one or two.
Mm-hmm.
How masterful he was in the studio at 19.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big audience there. He's relaxed. He's enjoying himself. He's professional.
And yet
then.
He's selling no records.
That, you know, that album deal, Ken Pitt, you know, Ken masterfully got that deal together. You know, out of nothing. And thank God he did. Yeah. You know, I mean...
That's what people don't realise, that Bowie... Yes, it was always going to happen, but it was so haphazard. I mean, that first album, which now goes for about $2,000, came out on June the 1st, 1967. All the same day as another one called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. So that wasn't the best day to release it, but that came out that day, didn't it?
But historically, it's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. You know, the fact that somebody of David's measure was coming out at that time, even though nobody knew it at that time.
Well, let's go through a few things you've asked us to bring through and tell us why. This is this here, if you can listen to this. What is this? I've not heard this. I don't know this. What on earth is this?
Well, I got asked about this many years ago, and people back then, some people kind of wondering whether did this have anything to do with David changing his name? It was the same year it came out.
What is it?
It's just a single by a band called The Wild Ones.
Yeah.
And it's called Bowie Man.
Oh, is that what this is? Okay.
Bowie. That's me.
Oh!
Bowie, call me the Bowie Man.
I had no idea about this. And so this was the influence? That was the...
No, I think it literally goes back to the Wild West with David. I mean, he was passionate about America, everything Wild West.
In America, they call
Jim Bowie. Bowie in America.
Bowie in America.
Yeah.
I never quite get that.
No, I can't.
Let's move on to something else.
And David would answer to anything.
What have we got here?
This is a curious one. This is Billy Fury. And I love Billy Fury. I think he was one of our true early great pop stars.
Uh-huh.
And one of the great early covers of one of David's songs, really, Silly Boy Blue, which is David's song.
Let's have a listen to a bit of this. Great in this trove and this wonderful stuff Kevin's got, and I've he's got the acetate disc of Bowie making Space Oddity, doing his own version of it,
yes.
And the words are different. not necessarily better.
But that's the point of a demo, isn't it?
It is, but to hear him singing that, as you good enough to play it to me, and you hear him sing, and the stars look very different today. Now I'd like to come back in now, if I may. that's not quite.
Let's get rid of that one.
Exactly. Yeah. So there it is. Ken Pitt gifts you with a lot of the stuff.
Yeah,
he has in his archive.
I've been picking up things all over the place, and you know, and buying things. You know, spending a lot of money over the years.
Yes, you did.
Purchasing things. So not everything was kindly given to me. Although probably some of the choicest things have been given to me. When I say given to me, a lot, you know, Ken's archive, I'm looking after. You know, it's for historical reasons for the future. You know,
exactly. But veer away. This is not just some fandom collection. This is a curation of things. I mean,
truly
you showed me a photograph, which I had seen of Bowie in about '69, leaning on a coffee table or sitting on a coffee table.
That's right.
And you were showing it to me, and we're looking at it. And then you said, by the way, look, and there was the coffee table. There, he said, that's it. That's that, and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That's
a big coffee table. You know, it was one of the central piece in Manchester Street, you know, at the time. And David stood on it for those mime photos and things. So, typical my phone.
Is that your phone?
I don't even know where it is.
That's not David Bowie's phone, is it, by the way? Because if it is, you know, I'll certainly buy that off. Oh, is that what it is? Your phone keeps going.
It didn't keep going.
Now, let me play something here. Where were you when this happened?
It won't happen again.
Where were you when this happened?
Oh, right.
Here we go. What's this? Here we go.
Of all the shows on this tour, this particular show will remain with us the longest.
This is 1972.
Not only is it the last show of the tour, but it's the last show that we'll ever do. Thank you.
Now, that's in 1972 when Bowie retired, but as he later explained, he retired Ziggy Stardust and not himself from it.
Mm.
You didn't actually see him till much later than that, did you?
Yeah, it was crazy, really. I mean, every time he was on, I couldn't do it for various reasons. And it was only really the later shows. It was only 73 ones that I was going to possibly see.
Mm-hmm.
And things like school and holidays and all kinds of things got in the way by, you know, days stopping me, and probably the lack of tickets, you know, being able to afford a ticket at the end of the day. But it was always, who knew he was going to finish at that time. That wasn't anyone's radar. So that announcement that you've just played there was massive. Seismic.
The group behind him didn't know he was going to say that.
Exactly. And we drove past it on the way in, and I pointed it out to my friends.
You managed Mick from... You were Mick Ronson's manager for a little while.
For a little while, he was a bit rudderless, and I was always a good friend, and so he just needed some help. So I basically, you know, we were trying to set up a tour. We were setting up a new album, which he was in the middle of writing and working on with others.
Is this the thing?
And then he became unwell.
This is the thing, Kevin. You've it's the ultimate fan's story. Here's somebody who thought, this guy's great, and gets not only to know him, but to manage Mick Ronson. I remember you saying he used to ring up and say, pick me up at the airport and things. When did you first meet David Bowie?
78, backstage at Earl's Court, but with loads of other people. I managed to...
How did you get backstage? I was at Earl's Court.
Yeah, very difficult, unless you just happen to be walking next to Mary Hopkin, who, and you're chatting away, and before you realise it, you're back...
You've been waved through.
I've been waved through everywhere.
Wow.
And all I was doing was just chatting to her, you know, as you do when you see Mary Hopkin. You would do, wouldn't you? And so we got in, and Tony Visconti sort of met us at the last sort of barrier, and of course... He was the keeper of the keys.
Yeah.
And we got into the caravan area.
He waved you through as well.
I was with Mary, you know, and Mary, you know, she, bless her, didn't...
But you weren't with Mary. This is what I find infuriating.
I know. Listen, how it happened is God's will, you know.
True enough. And so what did you say when you met Bowie?
David.
Me too, yeah, that's what I was pretty much.
You know, and, you know... He was just gearing up. He was just really quite excited, gearing up, ready to go on. Yeah. Actually, he'd already been on the first half, so he was really relaxed. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I wouldn't have dared go try and get back before.
All the stuff you got, and as I say, the Legion stuff in this collection, and the unreleased stuff. What's going to happen to that?
Well, I mean, I think probably it'll have to be kept together, but. You know what, you know, I'm not a pensionable age yet, so anything's possible.
Yeah.
You know, if I need to sell the odd thing, Danny, I'll give you a call.
But I can imagine a lot of David Bowie fans out there hearing, you know, this, you know, the Space Oddity thing and the various things you have got, and there's records I've literally never heard of.
They'll want it to be in a museum.
Yeah, exactly.
And the thing is,
will they ever be released?
Yeah, but, you know, I've done, over the years, as you might know, I've done a lot of repackaging and putting together, I'm working on lots of anniversary projects and things. And one of the biggest criticisms that was levelled at me occasionally, and certainly at EMI at the time, was why aren't we hearing all these rarities that we know are there, we demand to hear them, and how dare you stop us hearing them? Well, I've got to say, it's nothing to do with me, it's nothing to do with EMI, it's to do with, at that point, Mr. Bowie. You know, everything that came out is under David's control. And, you know, we might make some suggestions... But ultimately, it's up to David at that point. And now, of course, sadly, he's not with us, and it's up to his estate. So, yes, of course, in time, there'll be an anthology. We're always looking forward to doing an anthology. And you know, with any luck, you know, let's see what happens in the next 2 or 3 years. I mean, we might be able to start putting it together.
But there's no race. Well, there is for a lot of us here.
There is, I know. I agree.
When I've told people what you know, you've got and what you played me, and even this... absolute ephemera and minutiae of being, you know, doing the laughing gnome voices and hearing him swearing in that and him and Gus Dudgeon.
That was
doing...
tame what I played you, actually.
I know, but the idea... See, people think, I'd hear that. You're holding up their Manish Boys, David Jones and Lower Third. What's the deal with that?
Because the chap I came up with today played drums... And that's Mr. Phil Lancaster.
Oh, man, I love
to bring Phil in and say hello, really, shouldn't he?
We're getting the old band back together again. Yeah. I'm imagining myself in that back. How are you doing back there?
Bear in mind, you know, 50 years ago is the year... This is the year that, you know, that really Bowie became known, because the first David Bowie single came out in January...
In 66.
So, we are...
And tonight, David Bowie and the Buzz will be at the Drill Hall Newmarket on April the 30th, 1966.
Yeah.
In 1972, David Bowie and Friends, as he was billed, will be at the Guildhall Plymouth tonight, if you want to go and see him. And you've got a time machine there.
Wow.
Kevin, forgive me for being such a fan and talking to you in the academic way, perhaps. It should be, but...
The thing is, we could go on for hours. There's so much to cover. Bowie is a vast, vast subject.
He is, and I hope people who are not necessarily overwhelming Bowie fans can understand that this stuff is important, even if it's silly enough. We talked about the conversations between records and the idea that you've got handwritten lyrics and you've got his school books, that thing you showed me down from the shelf, a geography book, and in the front lens it had David Jones and an address, David Jones Jr. An address in Bromley, and in the back he'd written all his exam results.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this stuff was in private
What's
hands.
What's the one thing you've got that's the most special to you?
A number of things, but one something I didn't show you because it's big and unwieldy. I've got a beautiful Paisley shirt that David was often photographed in. the, you know, you can see it on fairly lots of covers and things. It's got it all. I've got it all framed.
How did you get David Bowie's
show?
Well,
that was something Ken did give me early on. I brought up some photos for him one day, and I always said, you know, if you ever get me in that shirt, I'm interested. And he just brought it out and said, "Is this a fair swap?"
Yeah. Well,
and it was just some basic photos. That's the kind man that Ken is. He's still with us. 93. Well,
Kevin Cairns, any day now, David Bowie, the London Years, 47. It's just an extraordinary archive. They made all that fuss about the V&A, quite rightly, but really the real show is in the hands.
And of course, the V&A got a lot of my things as well, Dan.
They did, but not all of them.
Not all of them.
Didn't know. Thank you very much for being with us, Kevin. I hope Bowie fans out there enjoyed that half an hour.
Well, thank you so much, Dan.
Online, smartphone and tablet. This is BBC Five Live.
With the headlines, I'm Jo Critcher. The Education Secretary, Nicky Morgan, has...